Committed vegetarians might be mildly grossed out by our discussion this hour, but it is neither a cooking segment nor a defense of eating meat, really. But it is certainly an exploration of why we eat meat, going back millions of years. You've heard the expression, you are what you eat? Well, the science of what we have become as a species from eating meat is nothing short of fascinating, and it helps explain why we still eat so much meat. Marta Zaraska is the author of Meat Hooked. And she has the envious pairing of titles of science journalist and travel writer. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post and New York Times, just to name a few places. You can add in Scientific American and National Geographic Traveler as well. Marta wrote two novels and contributed to a pair of travel books, before writing Meat Hooked. Marta Zaraska, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Good morning. I'm glad to be there.
Good to have you here. Let's start with the perspective. This is not a plea for vegetarianism, although you are a vegetarian yourself, or nominally so.
That's kind of correct. I'm kind of vegetarian. I mean, I'm not exactly the kind of vegetarian that vegetarians usually call vegetarians, I guess. First of all, I eat fish, so that's definitely a big no-no. Fish is meat, obviously. And I also sometimes also try some meat, like, you know, I will sneak a pepperoni slice of a friend's pizza or something like that. So I'm not very strict vegetarian, that's for sure. Sometimes I try eating vegan, sometimes I eat fish, sometimes I eat even meat, so it's complicated.
So, but the form of the book is really analysis over advocacy, correct?
Yes, it's definitely not an advocacy book. That's 100%. I just basically wanted to find out, you know, even for myself, what's so special about meat that people crave it so much. And, you know, even beginning with myself, I've been, you know, kind of vegetarian for 10 years now, and I still crave meat. You know, it's like when I smell a steak being grilled, I crave it. I want it. You know, the smell is delicious. And you know, studies show that, for example, 60% of vegetarians admit to having had meat within the last 24 hours. So, you know, so that means that this kind of phenomenon of craving meat is even widespread among vegetarians. They may not be admitting it to it very often, but they are doing it and they are craving meat, a lot of them. So there is something very deeply engraved in our, you know, genome or in our psyche that we really, really want meat. And I wanted to find out why.
Well, partly, I mean, if we start a little more recently, there is some culture involved here. You point out that particularly with your mother going vegetarian when she makes some very delicious Polish meat treats, it sounds like in particular for societies like Poland, there's a lot of cultural pressure to eat meat.
Oh, definitely. And whenever I go back to Poland, everybody, of course, knows in my family that I'm vegetarian. And yet, you know, whenever I'm at the table, I'm still offered, you know, all those sausages and pâtés and everything. It's just, you know, everybody wants me to just try it because, you know, it's so special and so good. And it's hard for people to understand. And also, you know, if you stop eating meat, in a way, you reject the societal norms. You know, you become different. You say no to common meals. And common meals are something extremely important for humans. You know, when we share food with other people, this is a big part of who we are, of our culture, of our family. And if you suddenly start eating different, you know, you're kind of rejecting this part of who you are and of your family, of your society. So it's a big thing for people.
When you write about family and culture in that portion of the book, I mean, it sends people off to thinking, well, yeah, we can think of certain meat-heavy cultures. The fact is that no matter what we think about Polish or Germans or anybody else, Americans probably outdo them all, don't they?
Almost. Not exactly. I think a small European country of Luxembourg actually eats more meat than Americans. And I think, for example, in Qatar, they eat more chicken per person as well. Per year, but in general, yes, Americans are definitely up at the very, very top among the meat eaters.
How many pounds per year? Do you have any figures nearby about what each of us eat individually?
So there is a number that's often quoted. It's 275 pounds, I believe, per person on average, of course, per year. And here is one also big thing because, you know, people think, okay, that's a lot of meat. You know, I'm not eating that much. And, of course, there are people who eat a lot. There are people who eat less. But also another thing to remember is, you know, in those numbers that it's not just meat per se. You know, it's not just steaks and sausages. You know, meat byproducts, so all those kind of parts of animals that don't become steaks or sausages, we also eat them sometimes without even realizing that. For example, you know, those kind of gummy bears, they contain gelatin, and gelatin is made of, you know, it's a meat byproduct. So a lot of things contain, in a way, meat, you could say, or meat byproducts, and we don't even realize we are eating them, and this all adds up.
Marshmallows even, I understand, too.
I think so, yeah. Everything that contains gelatin, so all the desserts, you know, Jell-O and things like that, they actually contain kind of meat.
When you look at the historical context for us eating meat as humans, culture aside, what surprised you the most?
You know, a lot of things surprised me when I was researching this book, because, you know, it's just there are so many things that keep us hooked on meat. And, you know, actually one of the things I think that I found the most surprising was that actually there is something in our genes that for some people can make it much more difficult to give up meat. And on the other hand, for some people, it can make it easier. So, for example, there is something called umami blindness. So umami is this fifth taste, which is Japanese for delicious. And this is a very big component of why we love meat. And research shows that about 3.5% of us are unable to detect this taste. So we are umami blind. We just cannot tell this taste. So if you are umami blind, this you can assume that, you know, you will not find things that are full of this particular taste as delicious as other people do. So, you know, meat may be not as appealing to you as to others.
All right, all kinds of stuff to talk about. Umami, again, the fifth taste. We've added that in the recent years to salty, sweet, sour, and bitter. We'll come back and talk more with Marta Zaraska, who's the author of Meat Hooked, the history and science of our 2.5 million year obsession with meat, and actually potentially goes a whole lot farther back than that. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. If you just look at the bottom half of the dust cover of Marta Zaraska's book, Meat Hooked, you think you're looking at a cookbook because there's this lovely shank of meat there. But the fact is, this is not a cookbook. It's really an analysis of why it is that we eat meat and how far back this goes. Meat Hooked is subtitled The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what it is, this connection between us and eating animals. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of animals eating other animals not only predates human, as you point out, but pretty much everything else. How far back does this go, Marta?
It basically goes back to the beginnings of life on Earth. So so first, you know, that first when there were only ancient bacteria on Earth, they already started eating themselves. It wasn't exactly meat eating because there wasn't particularly exactly meat back then, because meat is a muscle of an animal. So there were no animals, bacteria are not animals, obviously, but they were eating each other, and many scientists actually call it carnivory, so meaning that, you know, they were behaving like a lion towards a gazelle in a way. So they already started eating each other, and actually this led to a whole speed up of evolution, because when something is trying to eat you, it's a good idea to become bigger and harder to eat, basically, you know, to move faster, to run away, to start growing some hard shells to hide yourself. And this kind of started a race in a way that, you know, the hunter started to become bigger, the prey started to become bigger, and everything started growing on Earth, all the animals becoming faster and bigger and better protected. And this drove a lot in our evolution. And of course, the first animals, the first meat animals, were not kind of the animals that we're imagining right now. These were not obviously any cow-like things or even not fish-like things. Among the first meat eaters, meat on the planet were things that resembled anemone or like stacks of shot glasses, basically one on top of another. So it really goes very, very far back into the history of our planet.
You described quite an arms race, and you just gave us some of the details of it, between predator and prey, all kinds of defenses and ways to attack to pierce those defenses.
Yes, so there were, you know, at first the first meat eaters were not extremely aggressive. These were not sharks. They would just basically drill small holes in another animal, you know, tiny things like the thickness of our hair. But very soon, it started to change, and then they started to grow teeth or like conveyor belt like tongues with tiny little sharp teeth on them, and or eyes on stalks to see better. So it was really a true arms race, and up to the enormous kings of the oceans, you can say, something like Anomalocaris, for example, which was a huge, huge predator. I think it was as big as five lions put tail to nose kind of in a row. It was enormous. And so there were also huge, huge meat eaters, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago on this planet.
Now, you say that we became meat eaters because of climate change?
Yes, that's one of the leading theories right now among scientists, that because the thing was, why did humans, or our ancestors at some point, change our diet? Because before we were basically vegan. So we were eating such things as leaves, grass, even such rather unappealing to us things like tree bark, for example. And then suddenly we started eating meat about 2.5 million years ago. So the question was, you know, why? What happened? Why did we give up all this bark and leaves and grass and went for meat? So basically what might have happened, or rather quite likely has happened, is that the climate of our planet, actually in Africa, where these ancestors were living, has changed. It basically dried and got cooler, and all these plants that were so available before, they became harder to find. So the food that they were relying on was not so easy to find. On the other hand, because there was much more grass, there were much more animals grazing on this grass, and they became more abundant. So there were much more, suddenly there were more gazelles, there were more giraffes, more zebras, and also there were more predators. So there were many much more dangerous cats back then in Africa. So, for example, you had saber-toothed cats, three species as far as I remember back then in Africa. And all these animals were hunting, all these predators were hunting those gazelles and giraffes and so on, and often they were leaving unfinished carcasses. So, and such a carcass was something that our ancestors could have stumbled upon, and, you know, they were looking at it, wow, there's something, you know, why not try it? They saw other animals eating it, and, you know, basically by chance, you know, by stumbling upon it, they started to try it, and they discovered it's a good source of nutrition, and that's how it all started.
Marta Zaraska's book about our obsession with meat is called Meat Hooked. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Well, talking a bit about the resources needed to feed meat eaters in the sense of the food supply chain, but just within the organism, how much energy does it take to chase, consume, and digest meat?
How many what? Excuse me, can you repeat the question?
How much energy does it take to chase, consume, and digest meat?
How much energy does it take for us to consume, to digest meat?
Well, in other words, versus being vegetarians, it requires some different things of the animal, the actual organism, right?
I mean, yes. So, for example, for when our ancestors became meat eaters, their bodies had to adapt, because if you are a vegan, but not like vegans nowadays, where basically, you know, we have still bodies of omnivores. But for an animal that is vegan, like our ancestors before 2.5 million years ago, like they had very long guts. And these were guts adapted to digesting plant foods. And if such an animal, basically, or, you know, hominin, ate meat, like as much meat as modern Americans eat, for example, he would probably suffer horrible pains and diarrhea, even vomiting. He might have even died, precisely because his gut was completely unadapted to such a diet. So for us to be able to actually start eating meat, our guts had to adapt and change. And very likely why they were able to do that is because first, before we started eating meat, we started adding a lot of nuts to our diet. And because nuts are also very caloric, very full of energy and, you know, all the nutrients, really like a pack of dense, you know, nutrient foods, it allowed our guts to shrink a little bit, so they were not so prone to twisting and all these problems that would have our ancestors would have suffered if they ate, you know, a few steaks or a few burgers.
Do you cite some theories on our early ancestors about how they obtained meat? If they didn't hunt, how did they get it?
Yeah, so basically, our ancestors didn't start off as hunters. They started off as scavengers. So they were basically, you know, following hyenas and all the other animals and scavenging food. So and at the very beginning, they were so-called passive scavengers, meaning, you know, if they stumbled upon some meat, they would just, you know, eat it. Later on, they became something that's called active scavengers, meaning they would, for example, they will find a dead gazelle that some lions have hunted, and then they would chase off the lions or chase off the other predators from the meat. So that was a little bit more active than just, you know, stumbling upon something that's left over on the savannah. And only later on we actually became hunters once we, you know, perfected our skills and social coordination of the group and our tools as well. Then we could become hunters as well.
It's interesting, though, because you point out some studies that have been done about figuring how much meat that other animals leave behind. I mean, a lion, for as much as we talk about the lion chasing the gazelle down on the African plain, the fact is they leave a lot of meat behind, don't they?
Yes, that's right. I've talked to one scientist at the Smithsonian Institution, and she actually does research like that. So she basically drives around in her Range Rover on a savannah, and she finds those carcasses left by lions, for example, of a gazelle or a zebra, and then she loads the carcass into her car and takes it back to her camp, and she calculates exactly how much meat there is left over, and she found that they leave really huge amounts of meat. They, you know, you think that, you know, if they hunt an animal, they'll eat it, but no, there is really a lot of good quality meat left over. So for our ancestors, you know, that was easy food. You didn't have to really only, you know, suck on marrow out of bones, but you really had a lot of meat left over. And anyway, even bones and their marrow, you know, it's a very good source of quality food, so full of calories and nutrients. So they had really a plentiful, abundant foods to be found.
You can see how this happens, though, that, you know, the scavengers, you know, show up a few hours after a kill, a few minutes after a kill, immediately after a kill, and finally they just end up doing the killing themselves. It's a pretty easy way to look at the evolution, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, when you think about scavenging, because people tend to romanticize hunting, you know, we think that hunters are the kind of the kings and the scavengers are the lowly, kind of a little bit creepy animals like hyenas.
Right.
But it's not really that way. You know, scavenging it requires a lot of skills. And actually, lions scavenge a lot of food as well. And I think they even scavenge more than they actually hunt. And hyenas hunt, you know, as well, and not only scavenge. So scavenging requires a lot of skills, a lot of coordination, and you have to know when the animal is killed, and you have to compete with lots of other scavengers and other carnivores. So it's not, as you know, some kind of lower way of obtaining your meat. It's as good as hunting.
Marta Zaraska, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book about us and consuming other animals is called Meat Hooked, the History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Join the discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Questions, comments, and stories about your own meat consumption, welcome at 800-838-3760 or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Grumpy John and Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I had a family member who was a successful vegetarian, but for me it takes too much knowledge, too much forethought, too much planning to be vegetarian. My theory is this, that I think we became meat eaters after the development of ketchup so that it made hamburgers palatable.
All right, that's a good theory. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Marta, thoughts?
Yes, that's a very interesting point.
Let's talk about the serious part of what he said, though, the work it takes to be a vegetarian.
So here's the thing. That's true that actually many vegetarians, these people who try vegetarian diet, they admit that they go back to eating meat because they don't know how to do vegetarian diet, and especially they don't know how to cook vegetarian meals because, you know, we have something that's called eating scripts. So, for example, on our plate in our Western culture, you know, American culture, also Polish culture, on our plate we usually have protein, which is usually meat, then we have some kind of starch and two veggies. So, and there is kind of, when you look at your plate, that's, you know, you kind of see spots for it, you know, in your mind. In Asia, it looks differently. Like we have, for example, in Thailand, they have like lots of little bowls, and so it looks quite different on a table. But for us, if you take off this piece of meat from your table, from your plate, suddenly you have an empty spot. And people just don't know often how to deal with it. And, you know, you take off the meat, what are you gonna supposed to eat? So this lack of knowledge is a big problem. But when it comes to nutrition per se, the fact that, you know, that vegetarian diet is complicated is really nothing but a myth, because there is not, it's really hard to mess up vegetarian diet, because as long as you're eating reasonably, you know, varied foods, you will be fine. So, and but this applies also to eating food with meat. You know, there is really no difference.
But there are, you mentioned some stuff in the book though about people trying to make sure that they're combining the stuff that they're eating when they're eating vegetarian to make sure that they're getting the right amount of protein.
Yes, that's right. That's actually one of the so-called, I call them protein myths. So it goes back more or less to the 60s and 70s. And so it's true that meat has something that we call complete protein. So the protein in meat has all the amino acids, all the essential amino acids that our body needs. And most plants have so-called they have worse kind of protein. It's not so complete. It doesn't have all these essential amino acids. There are some plants that are complete in protein. For example, potatoes are like that. So if you went on a potato-only diet, so you had, you know, potato chips for breakfast, fries for dinner, and mashed potatoes for supper, you would be still fine. You would have enough protein. So that you will have some other nutritional problems most likely, but not problems with protein. But it is true that most plants, so if you take, for example, I don't know, carrots or beans or rice, they lack in some of those essential amino acids. So back in the 70s, one book was published. It was called The Diet for the Small Planet. It was a very big bestseller. And in this book, the author, she wrote that to make the protein complete, the vegetarians should be charting their meals and basically making sure that during every meal, they have all the essential amino acids on their plate. So basically, if you are eating, for example, rice, you would have to eat beans together with rice at the same time to make sure you had all these amino acids at the same time in one meal. And then, you know, all the newspapers started printing this chart and, you know, how to make sure you're getting this amino acids and that amino acids and so on. So it was very scary, you know. If I were to do something like that, I would go completely crazy. You know, that's too much work. So obviously, you know, so people didn't want to do that. But then, you know, there was obviously a lot of research done since then. And now we know that it's completely not true. So even the author of this diet in her 20th edition of the book, she admitted that she has made a mistake and kind of added to a new myth that started its own life since then. But it's absolutely not correct. So basically, our bodies are capable of complementing this amino acid by itself, just like with vitamins. For example, you know, you don't have to have all your vitamins at the same time, right? If you're eating dinner, you don't have to make sure that you have vitamin C and vitamin A and B12 and B6 and so on at the same time, right? And it's the same with the amino acids. You know, as long as your diet is reasonably varied, your body is capable of, you know, complementing themselves. And for example, example of complete protein that is as good as meat is a peanut butter sandwich. So you know, it's really easy. Or it is rice and beans, another one. There are so many of them that your body is really doing a great job dealing with protein.
But the idea of having the rice without the beans or the beans without the rice, I mean, do we have to have them within a day or something? Or just does the body just figure out what it's going to need when and you crave whatever you need?
You don't even crave it. You know, it's just like with the vitamins. You know, the body is perfectly capable of doing it all by itself, and that's why, you know, you've probably never heard of anybody telling you that they went to a doctor and the doctor said they had some kind of protein deficiency disorder or I don't know, some disease. That's because it doesn't really exist. That's the whole point. That's why you don't see people sick out of protein disease. I don't know. There is one disease that used to be thought that came from lack of protein, and it's called kwashiorkor. And this is the disease that in the 50s and 60s was a lot on television, you know, the poor children in Africa with their swollen tummies. And everybody went crazy about, you know, how they are not getting enough protein and so on. But this was also soon discovered that the problem with these children was that they were basically not getting enough calories. It was not about them getting enough protein, just not having enough to eat in the first place. And this is why you don't see people with kwashiorkor in lower Manhattan, because it's extremely hard to get it in the Western world, unless you are anorexic, for example. That's when you should be worried. But as long as you are not anorexic, then you will be fine.
All right. Now, we can be poisoned by too much protein. Is that true?
Yes, that's actually true. So if in your diet you eat more than 35% of protein, your kidneys may fail. So this is just too much for them to deal. And so there is even something called rabbit starvation. This is a disease that's been very widely described by explorers in 19th and early 20th century. So basically, it happens to people, for example, when they went to the far north and they would, in the winter there was barely anything to eat, and they would be surviving on eating squirrels and rabbits, for example. So small animals that are very lean, meaning their meat is packed with protein. So they were eating a lot of protein. And what would happen then? They would just start getting sick. So they would get weaker, they would have diarrhea. And,
wow, so rabbit starvation. We need to pick this up on the other side of a break. Rabbit starvation, one subject in Meat Hooked with Marta Zaraska, back on the Exchange. Talk more about this in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about our obsession with meat. Marta Zaraska is a science journalist and the author of Meat Hooked, the history and science of our 2.5 million year obsession with meat. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what it is in our bodies that makes us crave meat and what actually eating meat has done to our bodies through evolution. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to this story about rabbit starvation. So people trapped in the far north or exploring in the far north, nothing to eat but rabbits and squirrels, lean protein, and the body just can't handle it after a while?
Yes, that's correct. So obviously there were no modern lab studies done on rabbit starvation. I don't think they would find many volunteers willing to try it. But there are quite a lot of reports dating from the late 19th century or early 20th century where the explorers would be writing what would be happening to them, to their bodies, when they were eating all this lean meat full of protein, or to their friends and other explorers. And so it was quite bad. So, they are very, very descriptive and very bothersome paragraphs. And some people were even, writing that it can lead to death if you continue on such a diet. And you would be wasting, getting thinner and weaker and until the final day. So basically, most likely what happens is that just our kidneys, because that's what we actually know from modern science, that our kidneys cannot handle more than 35% of if more than 45% of calories in our diet come from protein.
Okay, good to know. Let's take a call here from Heather in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marta Zaraska.
Hi there.
Hi.
So this actually is kind of a two-parted thing. The first part was I was having a conversation with a young friend of mine a few years ago where, I've always said, we are meant to be carnivorous. We have teeth omnivores. We have teeth for plants and meat, and we shouldn't be cutting out the meat because that's what we're supposed to be eating. We're supposed to be eating a little bit of everything. And she made a really valid point that we've evolved to the point where we know how to get the nutrients that we need to get without having to eat the meat. And I think you might be touching on this in a few minutes later in the program, but it's getting to the point where producing the meat and eating the meat is becoming bad for us as a unit in the world. And that it would be the natural evolution to evolve away from meat because we can do that with our brains, knowing how to do it now. And I thought that was probably one of the very best arguments for not eating meat that I've ever heard. And then a step further was that I have a couple of really good friends who are avid hunters and really big meat eaters. And myself, I'm a huge meat eater, and I was raised on steak and potatoes, like I think most of Americans were. And I had to start thinking about it, and I say I'm addicted to meat. I can't imagine having a meal without meat. I'm trying to do it now. I'm raising children. I don't want them to be raised thinking they have to eat meat at every single meal, because you don't have to eat meat at every single meal. And raising the idea that you might be addicted to it and it might be hard to break in a biological sense was really an eye-opener to some of these hunter people. And I thought it was really, you touched in the very beginning of the program on the idea that there's a biological need that we have, that not everybody with that whole extra flavor thing, the Japanese word, that, you know, some people actually really, like, crave the meat. It's hard to stop eating it.
Okay.
I guess that was it.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Heather. Appreciate that. Yeah, the word you're looking for is umami. That's the other, the taste there. Now, you point out in the book, Marta, that there were times in that we thought that, that meat was necessary. I mean, in the 19th century, there's some stuff you go through about theories on meat as a necessity, which have been debunked. But the idea that Heather brings up about us being able to evolve away, what is the truth about any sense of actual addiction to meat? I mean, is there something in meat that we crave, but it doesn't have to come from meat itself? Is that right?
Yes. So there are a couple of, you know, parts of the story. So the first one is, again, the protein. So it is true that we crave protein. So studies show, actually it's not only a human thing, many, many animals have the same craving for protein. And studies show that if 15% of calories in our diet doesn't come from protein, we start craving protein. So, for example, if in Africa, there are some areas of Africa, people eat a lot of starchy plants and a lot of plantains, which are very low in protein. So if they subsist on such a diet, they may start craving protein. Of course, once again, you know, it doesn't have to be meat at all, but we do have this kind of inherent craving for protein, and because we culturally come to connect protein with meat, that's why, you know, we can understand it as a craving for protein from meat, when in fact it's just craving for protein. So it could be, the peanut butter sandwich. And another thing is, you know, that meat does have a very particular combination of flavors, of tastes that are very, very appealing to us. So just like in ice cream, you have fat and sugar that make a very potent mixture. That's something that we really, really crave and respond to. The same thing is with meat, but here the components are fat, the umami taste, and something that's called the flavors, the products of Maillard reaction. So this is a reaction that happens when you heat something in a very high temperature, some foods in very high temperature, dry temperature. So this is the same thing that happens, for example, when you bake cookies or bake bread. This is this kind of sense of browning, of being really heated up. And the same thing is, this is the dark area on your steak, for example, when you're grilling it. So this is the Maillard reaction. And these scents are very, very appealing to us. And this combination of umami, fat, and the Maillard reaction makes meat very craveable. So there is something very special to this particular product that makes it different from other foods.
So the mouth-watering is literal in some cases. It's not just a thing we think we're doing.
It is. It really is.
We talked about hunters just a bit, about how we actually might have been scavenging originally. And when you turn in the book to the story of true hunters historically, you bring up a point. It's a real oh yeah moment that, like, why did we go after the megafauna, like the mammoths and stuff like that, when it would have been that much easier to catch smaller animals and a lot less dangerous to us?
Yes, exactly. So this is a very big, also romantic myth again that we have, you know, that our ancestors were hunting these big mammoths and, you know, just mostly going for these really big animals. You know, we have the, you know, First Nations and you know, hunting bison and so on. And so, but the reality is that, you know, that from nutritional perspective, actually, it makes much more sense to hunt smaller animals, for example, exactly rabbits or you know, some gather eggs or some turtles and animals like that. So, for example, there were studies done on several hunter-gatherer tribes. And, for example, in one tribe in New Guinea, the hunters actually expend more calories hunting than they manage to get from their kills. So, basically, they'll be better off if they just stayed in their camp and slept all day. So, and in other tribes, this one is in Africa, the hunters, men who hunt, actually bring less food back to the tribe than small children manage to gather. So basically, hunting big game is not necessarily the best way to provide food for your family. It is true that once you get the mammoth, then there is a lot of meat, but you know the chances of getting one and the risk of dying in process are just not necessarily worth it. So the question, of course, was why did we do it? Why did we go for those mammoths? Why did these hunters, you know, go hunting instead of sleeping in their camps? So basically, it goes to something that the scientists call like showing off hypothesis. So basically, it's called costly signaling in science, which basically means that they want to signal that they are powerful and strong and good providers and good potential mates by hunting, because meat is a very special food. You know, when you think mm-hmm. about it, if you hunt a mammoth, that's a lot of meat, and this is a lot of meat that's going to spoil very fast. So you cannot eat it by yourself. You have to share it. And if you share it, it involves a lot of politics. Whom you're going to give a biggest piece? Whom you are not going to give anything? You know, it's a lot of politicizing going on around it, and even chimps do it. Even they use meat in the same way.
Wow, that's some pretty amazing stuff. Let's take a call here. John in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marta Zaraska, the author of Meat Hooked.
Hello. Hi. I'm age 69, and maybe 5 years ago I became more clearly aware that I have hypoglycemia problems, and I have for years before that have always tried to eat less meat. But now I find that even if I eat protein like eggs and rice and vegetables, it's fine, but it just doesn't have the staying power. Maybe an hour and a half later, I'm starting to get weak again.
All right. Thanks for the story. Appreciate that. Let's go on to another story from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. There's a very interesting book that I recommend by a fellow called Richard Wrangham, called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. His hypothesis, and it is a hypothesis, like global warming, it's not yet proven, but his hypothesis is that man advanced rapidly, physiologically, when, probably by accident more than anything, he discovered that meat cooked is that much more efficient to the alimentary system. And indeed, modern man would be incapable of being the scavengers that you were talking about, who presumably only ate raw meat. We are not capable now of eating raw meat. I don't have the problem myself because I'm a vegetarian, but it's just an interesting observation, I thought.
All right. Thanks for that, Tony. Appreciate it. What did you find out about cooking versus not cooking meat, Marta? Did you look much into that?
Yes, I did actually. I interviewed Richard Wrangham quite extensively for the book, and it is true in that he found in his studies done at Harvard that generally cooked food gives us more energy. So in a way, it's more caloric, you could say, and it also applies to meat. So if we cook meat, it's easier to digest. It provides us with more energy. So basically, what Richard Wrangham claimed was that it was the cooked meat gave us additional power to, you know, to evolve, because it was so much more caloric and easier to eat as well, because we have very weak jaws, you know, compared to other actual real carnivores like lions, for example. We have extremely weak jaws. So if you wanted to bite off a piece of zebra, you know, a dead zebra that was just lying there, you couldn't do it because we have really weak teeth and jaws. So cooking really enabled us to eat a lot of meat, because we were eating all this meat, we could also grow bigger brains, because we needed meat and its caloric and nutritional value to enable us exactly to grow bigger brains. And cooked meat was even better than raw meat in that regard.
So it gave us certainly some energy stores for our own body. We've talked about the energy expended in hunting, and particularly in cases where people are going after big game and can actually save the calories by just staying in bed. But let's talk about resources used to actually produce meat, because the figures are still fairly staggering on just what it takes to produce a hamburger in terms of the energy and resources used and a global warming impact.
Yeah, that's quite staggering, actually, the number that keeps, mesmerizing me the most is actually that of all greenhouse gases released by humans, about 14.5% come from livestock. And this is about the same as emissions from all of the transportation combined. So all the passenger cars, all the trucks, all the ships, all the airplanes, taken together is the same as eating meat. So, you know, we put so much energy and a kind of effort into, for example, designing solar-powered cars or, you know, more efficient airplanes. And at the same time, this is so much less than eating meat. So this is something that I find really, you know, amazing. You know, just each burger contributes to global warming as much as driving a typical, you know, average American car for about 320 miles. So this is, it's a really huge impact.
Wow, one burger, 300 miles. That's pretty amazing. Let's talk about the future and laboratory-grown meat and whether the science looks at all promising.
So it does. It's quite, it's absolutely fascinating. I actually had an honor of visiting the lab in the Netherlands where the meat is growing in this little petri dishes. And of course, we are still quite far away from having, you know, lab-grown meat in Walmart or, you know, in just every supermarket. Although the producers are saying that in three to 5 years, some very high-end restaurants might start serving it. So it is something, you know, that we can definitely envision, and as long as people, you know, overcome their yuck factor and stop being disgusted by it, as still vast majority of people react this way to the thought of lab-grown meat, this is definitely something that could help us with the global warming problem of conventional meat.
Well, I guess we'll get a chance to see in a few years then whether the yuck factor does enter into it for us. The book is called Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Marta Zaraska wrote it and joined us today in Exchange. Marta, pleasure to visit with you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
All right, take care.